Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, and happy President's Day to you. Frankly, I'm still offended that they changed the holidays from the President's birthday of Washington's birthday celebration and then Lincoln's birthday to this combined Monday deal. But nonetheless, even as most Americans are out doing whatever they're going to do on this Monday anyway, and President's Day is known mostly as a banking holiday and an opportunity for special sales in the department stores, today we're going to be talking about our first president, George Washington. And in particular, we're going to be talking about George Washington as a case for historical revisionism. Why is it that so many contemporary historians are dead set, absolutely ardent in their argument that George Washington was a deist? That is, that he simply believed in some kind of God, like nature's God, that he didn't believe in a personal God. We're going to be looking today at the evidence. We're going to see that that's completely wrong. Now, there are some Christians that go too far and try to baptize, basically, all the founding fathers and argue for a unified Christian understanding, an evangelical understanding, as a matter of fact, among the founders. That's not legitimate. But today we're going to be looking at George Washington, and I think you're going to be surprised by some of what you're going to hear. We're going to have as our special guest Peter Lilbeck, who is the author of Sacred Fire, a very important new book about George Washington's Christian faith. And we're going to be looking at the fact that in George Washington's personal writings, there are deeply embedded the very kinds of expressions, thoughts, sentiments, and convictions you would expect of a devout Anglican Virginian, which he was. We'll be looking forward to that in just a few moments. And, of course, we want to invite your calls. We're going to be talking about why so many modern historians and others want to insist that George Washington, among others, were just deists when the evidence is to the contrary. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. First, to review some other issues in the news, I was absolutely shocked overnight. I actually sat down to write an article on Time Magazine's cover story for this week, and we're going to be talking about that, by the way, but let me just move on and say, preparing to write that article, I was instead struck by the news that's on the front of the Times of London this morning. That is one of the greatest institutions of the press in Great Britain. In many ways, the Times is the most establishment of the establishment media in Great Britain. And when they run on their front page a story saying that senior bishops of the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church are ready to support a proposal for union under the papacy, that is very big news. According to the report that was leaked to the paper, a 42-page report has been put together by a team involving senior leaders of both the Roman Catholic Church and the Church of England, suggesting that it is now time for the two churches to move into a shared communion. But, of course, it's not a communion of equals. You're looking at over a billion Roman Catholics. You're looking at approximately 78 Anglicans worldwide. And you're looking here at a call for the Church of England to come under the supervision and oversight, what's called the Episcopal Ministry, of the Bishop of Rome. That is Benedict XVI. That is the Pope. Now, we've been living in an ecumenical age for the last century or so. We've been living in an age in which there are many persons who are calling for the churches just to set aside their differences, how deep they may be, and simply join together in a common effort. Most of these ecumenical efforts have ended in theological and spiritual disaster. As a matter of fact, if you take the leading ecumenical movements, such as the World Council of Churches and the National Council of Churches, you'll see that most of the churches involved in those communions are on the far, far left, and they've been losing members for most of the last several decades. They are negotiating their way into absolute theological minimalism, and if they're not there already, they soon will be united in the fact that they disbelieve most of the common Christian faith, most of the central doctrine of the Christian faith, or at least allow the denial of those doctrines within their communions. And again, they're just hemorrhaging members all over the place. But when you talk about the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church coming together, it just, for me, raises all kinds of questions. Let's remember what we've been talking about over the last several weeks. We've been talking about the possibility of schism, of absolute rupture within the Anglican Communion. Right now in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, 35 of the 38 primates of the Anglican Communion are meeting together in a last-ditch effort to try to avoid absolutely coming apart over the issue of homosexuality. So how in the world would the Church of England now merge with the Church of Rome? I mean, after all, to give the Church of Rome a clear understanding of its positions on these issues, on issues of women's ordination, it's absolutely out. Well, the liberals in the Church of England and in the Anglican Communion have been amazingly successful in pushing that agenda, especially in the Church of England and in the Episcopal Church USA. And now you have the suggestion they'll be coming under. You see, I think it's an interesting left-right polarity here. People on the conservative side, well, they may see the Roman Catholic convictions on abortion and homosexuality and other issues as very attractive, but they'll be opposed to the papacy, and they certainly are interested in a lot of the more liberal movements that come with Roman Catholicism. People on the left may want to associate with the Catholic views on social justice, but they're hardly going to be excited about the views of the Roman Catholic Church on women, sexuality, and other issues. Now, as an evangelical, I have to look at this and wonder if the Church of England is simply losing its mind. Let's remember that in the 16th century, the Church of England broke with the papacy under the leadership then of King Henry VIII, but the issues were always more than Henry VIII's desire for an annulment of the marriage, a divorce from his first wife, Catherine of Aragon. They always went more deep and more serious than that in terms of the consequence. And what you have right now is apparently the fact that evangelicals in the Church of England must be headed into apoplexy. Because after all, let me just mention three names, Latimer, Ridley, Cranmer. They were martyrs for the cause of the faith, of the gospel, of the Reformation. And so by the time you get just a few decades away from Henry VIII's break with the Church of Rome, you have the Church of England officially declaring itself to be of no account to the papacy. As a matter of fact, it says the Bishop of Rome hath no jurisdiction in this realm of England. And that's a very important point. You know, just in the next generation after Henry VIII, under Elizabeth I, the famous Elizabethan settlement was reached, whereby the church clearly became a Reformation church. Not to the extent of what you would find perhaps in Presbyterianism, but certainly a Reformation church. And, of course, then you have the heritage of the Puritans. Let's just say that that heritage has been very clearly defined as based in evangelical Protestantism, in absolute revolt against the papacy and the doctrines of the Roman Catholic Church. It's going to be fascinating to watch, as if this church didn't have enough controversy already. This report's just a reminder to us that we're living in the most unstable of times, even when it comes to issues like the existence of the Roman Catholic Church over against the Church of England, etc. Now, don't expect something on this to just explode overnight, but be aware, the times they are changing. We've been talking about the HPV vaccination, the human papillomavirus vaccination. In the state of Texas, Governor Rick Perry, as you now well know, has ordered a mandatory vaccination of all girls by the time they reach the sixth grade. The New York Times is out with a very fascinating story indicating that opposition to the governor's move and opposition to the idea of mandatory vaccines nationwide are bringing together, this opposition is bringing together an interesting coalition of the right and the left, a coalescence of conservatives and of liberals who have common concerns about the mandatory nature of this order. Now, let me tell you why the conservatives are upset. The conservatives are largely upset because they're concerned about parental rights, and they're also concerned that the HPV vaccination is the first vaccination against a disease that is venereal. It is spread through sexual misconduct and promiscuity. Obviously, if sex is only within the monogamous fidelity of marriage, there would be no spread of the HPV virus. And so there are a lot of conservatives that are upset about that. On the liberal side, there is equal concern, not so much over the sexual morality issue and not so much over the parental authority issue, but over the fact that it looks like this particular vaccine is being pushed by big business with a big profit motive. And you're talking about the potential by the manufacturer, Merck, the potential by its own reports of a $5 billion business. You're talking about big business. And when the state makes a vaccine mandatory, well, it makes the copyright holder, the patent holder of that particular vaccine very wealthy through that one move. It's very interesting. And I would suggest you look at this story at the New York Times. It's entitled Furor Over Push for Cervical Cancer Vaccine. And all of a sudden, you have a very strange coalition coming together, the left and right, because there is common concern that this kind of mandatory order violates the way this vaccine ought to be handled. And I'm in agreement with that. My concern is, first of all, parental rights. I think parents ought to have the right to determine whether or not they will have their daughters vaccinated. And to me, that's just very simple to understand. If your child can't get a tonsillectomy without you signing your life away in terms of permission, I think similarly it ought to be true in this kind of vaccination. And the reason why this should be different than, say, polio or a tuberculosis vaccine is that this is a disease that spread through conduct. No one sneezing at the next desk in a second grade classroom is going to spread the human papillomavirus. Read up on it yourself. Christian parents need to be informed. We need to be ready to make decisions that are grounded in genuine Christian thinking. We want to know how our first president was thinking. Was he thinking as a Christian? We're going to talk about it with special guest Peter Lilbeck coming up right next on the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program, and again, happy President's Day to you. For the last several decades, it has become the custom in academic history circles to minimize the Christian conviction of George Washington, the nation's first president. And of course, Washington is a contested historical figure. I mean, one of the things we learn about Washington is that a lot of what we think is true about him isn't true. Going all the way back to the kind of what's called hagiography, the kind of stories that were popularized by Parson Weems about cutting down the cherry tree and all the rest. In reality, the true George Washington is a lot more interesting than the fictional George Washington. He is, by any measure, one of the most amazing figures, not only in American history, but in the history of the world. It's hard to imagine the American Republic without this one man who had the confidence of his countrymen to such an extent that the presidency itself was largely defined around him, assuming that he would be the first incumbent of the office. We're living in a very strange day, and we're living in a time when historians have been arguing, especially over the last several decades, that George Washington was a deist. Now, let me be the first to say several of our founding fathers were deists. And deism simply refers to a theological movement that denied that God is a personal deity involved in the everyday affairs of the world. This is a God that created the world and then is separate from the world, operating only through the natural forces and laws he put into place. You would not pray to a deistic God. You would certainly not expect intervention because, by definition, he would not do so. Michael and Jana Novak, writing in today's edition of USA Today, set the record straight on the issue of Washington's confidence in divine providence. They point out that he could not possibly be a deist because, after all, he both prayed for and was certain that he experienced the intervention of God's providence, not only in his life, but in the life of the nation. In his life, going back to when he was a young man and a bullet missed him, and he was confident it was because God was protecting him for a special cause. By the way, the Novaks are the author of the book Washington's God, Religion, Liberty, and the Father of Our Country. Another book I want to draw to your attention is entitled Sacred Fire. It is by Peter Lilbeck, who is the president of Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, where he also serves as professor of historical theology. I think Peter Lilbeck takes this argument to an even deeper level than the Novaks, and I'm very glad to welcome him today to the Albert Miller Program. Dr. Lilbeck, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be on this show today. Thank you for your kindness.
Well, it's good to have you on as a seminary colleague and also to have you on today, especially because of your expertise on George Washington. And I am often embarrassed, Dr. Lilbeck, by the fact that some of our brothers overclaim the founding fathers as evangelical Christians. Do you share a bit of that embarrassment?
I do indeed. If we're going to be careful historians, we need to let each person's faith stand in its own integrity. In other words, we can't homogenize everyone into Jefferson or Washington or one theological view. People then were just as different as people today. And so if we're going to be faithful as scholars, we need to put people exactly where they were. And the evangelical movement, as we know it today, wasn't exactly alive back then. The people there had different creedal confessional expressions as well. So we need to do some careful work. And they weren't by any means all of the same stripe.
Well, I think historians and writers like the Novaks, for instance, do a good job of basically demolishing the idea that George Washington was a deist. But the most they really claim, I think, is that he basically believed in divine providence, what the Novaks call a Judeo-Christian God. I think it's a lot deeper than that. I think you really demonstrate that in Sacred Fire, which, by the way, is a massive work of historical research. Let me just offer a thesis, and you tell me if you think this is right.
All right.
When I read George Washington, I especially appreciate what you drew out of his writings that would not be so accessible. I see a man that I would describe as kind of a devout Virginia Anglican. in a part of the country where the kind of fervor that you might find, for instance, in Sandy Creek in North Carolina, et cetera, did not exist. And so you find Washington talking the way that devout Christians of his time and his place would have talked. Would I be wrong in assuming that?
No, I think you have said it perfectly. You've hit the nail right on the head. Washington was a Virginian. He was raised four generations in the Anglican tradition of his community. And so he spoke like Virginian Christians did. They didn't have that expressive evangelical fervor that was so much a part of the Great Awakening and the evangelical churches. But that didn't mean they didn't hold to the gospel, because after all, he took vows to the 39 Articles of the Church of England. And one of those vows that he took included belief that Jesus Christ is the only hope for the forgiveness of sins and that we're justified by faith in him. I think one of the fascinating points is that some eight or nine times in Washington's life, he was willing to stand publicly as a sponsor of children in baptism. And to do that in that day, you literally had the Apostles' Creed spoken to you line by line, and at the end you had to say, "I do most solemnly believe." And Washington saw himself as a man of great character, of absolute integrity. And it's fascinating that Jefferson, when he was asked to be a sponsor of a child, said, "You know, I can't do that. As a Unitarian, I can't take those vows of baptism." Washington did it on eight or nine times, and it required a commitment to the Christian faith, and he did it publicly. As a man of character, he would have been very remiss to violate his conscience in any way, just like Jefferson, if he wanted to step into that role. So I think you're right. He was an Anglican, he was a public figure, and he was very careful to reflect the heritage of his community. The last expression that I like to remind people about is that there's actually a letter where he writes off to England and says, "You know, would you send me a prayer book? I want it to be with red Morocco leather. I want the metrical psalms in it." Obviously, he must have wanted to sing the psalms. But more importantly, he gave the exact dimensions that he wanted. He said, "So I can carry it with me in my pocket." As a good Anglican, he used the prayer book, and he wanted to have a personalized copy that he could carry right with him wherever he went. And the tradition is that they found him regularly in morning and evening prayer in the army, and often in private devotions and other examples. Even his enemies admitted he was a man of prayer. The London Chronicle, I think it was like of 1778 or 9, speaking of the enemy general, George Washington, said he's a man known to pray regularly in his tent. So even the enemies had to admit it. So he was a good Anglican.
Yeah, Dr. Loebach, speaking of that, I think one of the things that would often trip up, an evangelical Christian of the 21st century, in reading the very material you cite from George Washington, would be the formality of his expressions. And yet, I think I understand that. You know, but when you look and you see Washington referring to God as the supreme being, using this kind of terminology, a lot of modern people would say, "Well, look, he's trying to distance himself from the God of the Bible." You're arguing that he's not doing that at all.
That's an excellent point. In fact, many scholars who claim that Washington was a deist do something like this. Look at his titles, the supreme author of the universe, supreme being, the creator. Those aren't Christian titles. Those are deist titles. And everybody said, "Oh, I guess that's right." So I actually went out and took the classic deist text, which is the work called The Age of Reason by Thomas Paine, and said, "All right, what titles does he use for God?" And you know what? He doesn't use any of those alleged titles for God. His titles for deity are only three, four, or five maybe phrases. They're very small, and they aren't these. But then I pulled a sermon off the shelf of Washington's library. It happened to be a great Presbyterian preacher, one that we still have his works in print. His name was Samuel Miller, an evangelical Presbyterian. And you know the kind of titles that were being used in his sermon? The very kind that Washington was using. And so there's some 95 different titles for deity I've been able to identify. And Washington, in that Baroque spirit of never wanting to speak of God in the way he did before, he was showing the variety, the variegated qualities of God in his beauty. And that's something a deist didn't do. If you had a deist view of God, he was just God, the creator, the first cause. But for Washington, there's a vast array of titles that were used by the great preachers of his day.
Dr. Loebach, we're going right in.
That he were in his library.
We're going right into a break here. Can you hold on to stay with us another segment this afternoon?
I absolutely can. I'd be honored, sir.
That's great. To join the conversation, give us a call at 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. There are an awful lot of amateur historians out there. And frankly, there are also some students, say in high school, middle school, or in college, who've heard about a very different George Washington than the one Dr. Loebach's talking about. Call us. Let's set the record straight. 877-893-8255. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Let me ask you, how well do you know the Founding Fathers? In particular, how well do you know President George Washington? You know, there's hardly a name that could be more familiar to Americans in terms of our own history, and yet for a lot of Americans, he's a fairly remote character. For academic historians, well, a figure of some controversy. Let me read to you this statement made: historians ought no longer be permitted to turn Washington into a deist, even if they found it necessary and acceptable to do so in the past. Simply put, it is time to let the words and writings of Washington's faith speak for themselves. The author of that line is Peter Lilback, who is the author of Sacred Fire. And he is our guest today on the Albert Mohler Program. Dr. Lilback, let me welcome you back to the program and ask you to respond to that very statement which you wrote.
Thanks, Dr. Mohler. What a privilege. Yes, basically what we know is there's a famous line that historians use. It's a maxim. It says, the living can make the dead do any tricks that they find necessary. You see, the dead can't defend themselves. Our goal as authentic researchers is not to make someone into what they weren't, but to let their words and their historical setting or milieu speak for themselves. And when you do that, it is a clear record from Washington's own words that he was a Christian. For example, he said, on my honor and the faith of a Christian, what I've written is true. He told the whole nation, he said, if we're going to be a happy nation, we must imitate the divine author of our blessed religion. He said this, the blessed religion revealed in the Word of God will remain an eternal monument, what human beings can do in their depravity to corrupt the best institutions. He believed in depravity, the Word of God, the divine character of Christ, revealed in natural religion. He said he was a Christian. Well, those words were utterly unthinkable for a deist to have spoken.
Oh, absolutely.
And he did that in a public setting.
Dr. Lilback, I often think of the anecdote about Calvin Coolidge, you know, a very different president. He came back one day from experiencing worship. His wife had been ill and unable to attend. He came back to the White House, and she said, well, how was the sermon? He said, it was fine. She said, what was it about? The president said, it was about hell. She said, what did the preacher say? And the president, known for being a man of very few words, said he was against it. One of the things I appreciate is that George Washington evidently actually listened to the preacher. One of the things you document in your book is that he wrote notes, letters, and references to the sermons he heard.
It is amazing. We don't know this anymore, but Washington literally collected sermons. There are about 7 volumes of sermons he personally bound together, and he labeled them. He called them his sermons on religion, his sermons on liberty, his sermons on the Masonic faith. He was collecting them, and in many cases, they were sent to him by preachers, and he would write back and say, I've read your sermon. The doctrine in it is sound. My favorite one is one where the very sermon that he said was the doctrine is sound and he agreed with it was one that was anti-deist and pro the deity of Christ and presents the gospel clearly. And Washington, who said, there is no guile in me. I'm a man of candor and honesty, a man of character. He wouldn't have said those things. He didn't have to say them unless he believed them. And that's,
you know, one
confessed.
Of the things historians look for is primary source material, and that means from the source himself. And so Washington's words get to trump modern historians' interpretations of him. To join the conversation, give us a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This kind of conversation is a lot of fun because we're setting the record straight about something that's really important. Some of you may have questions about George Washington or anything we've been talking about today. It's fair game to give us a call, 877-893-8255. On the line from Winter Haven, Florida, is John, listening on XM-170. John, go right ahead.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to ask the author how his faith squares with his Masonic beliefs, and you mentioned in there his Masonic leanings. Could you address that?
Yes, I think that's a very important question. When we ask, was Washington a Mason? The answer is absolutely he was. There is no question. Now, for many people, that's a slam dunk proof that he could not have been a Christian, because everybody knows that if you are a Mason, you are a deist or an unbeliever or you're an anti-Christian. Now, let me be very clear. I'm not a Mason. I've never been a member of the Masonic order. I've not made a careful study of the Masonic teaching today. But what I have done as a historian is to go back into the context when Washington was alive, and what did the Masons believe then? And in his library, I mentioned these Masonic sermons. Right out of Washington's library, there was a sermon that was written by an Episcopalian clergyman that actually was a leader of the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And this sermon is his footnote. He actually includes the bylaws that were part of the Masonic fraternity that Washington was affiliated with. And here's what it said. No stupid atheist or deist may be a member of our fraternity. Why? Because they are Christian Masons. In that sermon, this is what this clergyman went on to say.
Dr. Loebach, I'm sorry, we're going right into a break. Hold that thought for just a moment, and folks, you hold right on. This is a fascinating conversation, setting the record straight. Coast to coast, this is the Albert Mueller Program, and we'll be right back. Welcome back once again. You know, intellectual integrity is a matter of our moral responsibility. We need to make certain that our thoughts are actually based upon a careful analysis of reality. And in history, we've got to be careful we're not lying by our retelling of the story. Everyone has an investment in history. The secularist tide of the last 100 years or so has certainly been inclined towards trying to secularize the nation's founding era, and that means also the founding fathers. My guest today is Peter Loebach. He is the author of Sacred Fire, and I think he's done an incredible job of really kind of uncovering the real George Washington, a devout Virginia Anglican of his times who clearly believed that he had a purpose that God had raised him for, had protected him for, and for which he was going to devote his life to his country. Dr. Loebach, let me ask you, when you think about the Founding Fathers, certainly we've got a spectrum here, and just to try to lay it out, I would put Jefferson and Franklin somewhere out there on the far left, Thomas Paine even more secular than they. But you're placing George Washington clearly within the realm of Orthodox belief. What about John Adams?
I think John Adams showed himself to be a believer that was serious. I think in his later years he began to be pulled in the Unitarian direction. I think in the earlier years he had more of a historic Calvinistic understanding. His son, John Quincy Adams, was profoundly evangelical. So it's interesting that even our fathers moved in their faith depending what time of life they were thinking and what they were reading.
And someone like Patrick Henry was clearly an evangelical, and even though he, too, was a Virginian, evidently he had been more in the revivalistic strain than had George Washington.
That is right. I think he was influenced by some Presbyterians in his area, and they made a big impact on his thinking. He was more evangelical.
So what would you say, for instance, I'm going to debate Susan Jacoby tomorrow at the Washington Post and Newsweek's website. She's the author of Free Thinkers, arguing for a basically secularist interpretation of American history. What would you say to that tidal wave of history that you document so well in your book that suggests that the Founding Fathers were basically deists as a whole? What difference does that make? I mean, you invested a great deal of your life in writing this book, and it's not just because George Washington is an intellectual hobby for you. Why is this question important?
Well, I think George Washington, as our first president, established precedents by everything he did. And by showing that Christian leadership and principles could operate under our Constitution, he gives to every other Christian the opportunity to do exactly the same. We belong in the public square because we've been there from the beginning. If our founding fathers showed us the way, we should follow the same example. So I think it calls us to be salt and light in our culture with our Christian values.
Well said. My guest today has been Professor Peter A. Loebach, who is also president of Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. If you go to my website at albertmueller.com, you'll find the first article at the weblog. We'll have a link to his book, Sacred Fire. I would encourage you to order it and read it and consider his argument very carefully. And I want to say, as a Christian reading it, I think you're likely to find not only some real substance for intellectual thought and for the exercise of your mind, but also some spiritual sustenance as well. There's a connection there with George Washington that you may never have known before. Dr. Loebach, thank you for joining us today on the Albert Mueller Program.
Dr. Mueller, it's a tremendous honor. Thanks so much.
Well, we'll do it again. Folks, there's still time for you to call. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Someone out there may have an itch about George Washington you really want to talk about. And I'll tell you, I get emails all the time from students in colleges and universities who write me, this is what I'm being taught. I'm being told that George Washington was a deist. You know, what do I do with that? I'm being told that the founding fathers were really secularists. I'm being told that they simply used the language of traditional Christianity or the language of deism in order to make their argument because that was simply the expectation of the time. And I think the kind of conversation we're having here today is important because it reminds us that we really have a responsibility to go back to the sources. We have a responsibility to go back to the men, to their writings, and also to go back to their times. I think one of the most effective things that Peter Lilback does in his book, Sacred Fire, is to say, look, if you're going to hear George Washington, the real man George Washington, you're not going to expect to hear him as if he's a member of the First Baptist Church of your local southern city, or as if he's a member of a suburban megachurch. You're not going to be hearing him speak as if he's just been to a Billy Graham crusade. You're going to hear him speak as a Virginia Anglican of the late 18th century, which is what he was. And so the way, the language, the liturgy, the devotion would have been expressed in his culture is the way we should expect to hear George Washington speak. And that's why I really appreciated what Dr. Lilback said about, for instance, George Washington's reliance upon the prayer book. You know, that was the tradition in which he was raised. That's how he made the clear connection. And he wanted the metrical psalms so that he could sing, the metrics being the actual notes and notations concerning the tune. He also responded to the responsibilities of his time by clearly identifying himself as a Christian. Dr. Lilback mentioned how he stood in for infants who were being baptized. Again, he was an Anglican, later what you would call an Episcopalian, given the break with the Church of England in the Revolutionary era. And, you know, even, I have to say, as much as I thought I was in tune with that era, and with that particular concern, knowing that the Apostles' Creed was recited and had to be affirmed personally by the one standing in, that's quite a statement. George Washington would never have done that if he did not want to make a public declaration of his identification with Orthodox classic Christianity. You know, one of the other, I think, matters of confusion of our time is that we tend to think that secularism is a new idea. We tend to think that free thinking, agnosticism, atheism, deism, that these are things that are basically of modern invention. Well, that's true in one sense. If you're going to define modern as in the entire modern age, if you're going to go back to the Enlightenment of the 17th century and suggest that whatever comes with that and after that's modern. But when we're talking about American history, you need to realize that the founding era in the United States was a time of incredible intellectual confusion. It was a time of incredible diversity. Even among the founding fathers, you had some that were the far left in terms of their thinking. And yes, I would have to put someone like Thomas Jefferson pretty much on that far left. Thomas Jefferson, for instance, was a great admirer of the French Revolution that came later, whereas many of the founding fathers and their heirs were appalled by the secularism of the French Revolution. On the other hand, you did have someone like the Adams family, and in particular John Quincy Adams. And here you had also the man George Washington, who clearly sought to identify himself as a devout Anglican Christian. Are there matters of complication about George Washington? You bet there are, because he was a man reticent to speak a great deal about himself, and so that leaves us with a lot of questions. I still have a big question about his Masonic membership. How did he square that with Orthodox Christianity? That's a question I wish I could ask George Washington. I can't. I'll simply have to look at the historical sources and try to figure it out honestly from what we find there. I'll be right back with some final thoughts in just a moment. I'm Albert Mohler. Well, history is always a controversial subject. It was that way when the first historians began writing. The Greek and Roman historians and others found themselves sometimes in a great deal of hot water, because when you're talking about history, you're making decisions not only about what happened and what didn't, but about, of course, what it means. And when you talk about current debates in America having to do with church, state, religious liberty, you name it, even the separation of powers, the role of the judiciary, history has a lot to do with this. I want to end today by talking about a trend in contemporary history studies that really does concern me. There is the suggestion that the great man theory of history should be thrown away. And the great man theory of history is basically what its opponents characterize as a way of reading history through the deeds and the sayings and the achievements of great men. And they say that, you know, basically that's not a realistic way to understand history. History is really not about great men and their words and deeds. It's rather about the common people and their engagement with their issues and the events of everyday life. Well, the problem with either of these arguments is that both are true and neither is true. It's not either or. It's not that it's either the great man of history or the common experience of humanity. Of course, it's both. But as a leading historian wrote just recently, most people who are doing the everyday living of life, milking their cows, planting their crops, and raising their children, don't have biographies written about them. They don't leave voluminous letters, and there's not a big historical record. There is a big historical record about the men like Julius Caesar and Henry VIII and, you know, George Washington and Winston Churchill. It's because they were men that had decisive roles in history. They were men without which you really can't understand why certain big world events happened and why others did not. I'm going to suggest to you that from a Christian understanding of history, we need to understand that history is more than the great man theory of history or the great woman theory of history. It's more than being about Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt and Margaret Thatcher and Julius Caesar. But it's not less than that. And in our understanding of how we should read and study history, we need to look with an eye of Christian integrity to looking at these great persons of history, and well, for that matter, the great who are famous and the infamous as well, and learn from them the lessons of what history would tell us about the moral character of humanity, about the possibility of human achievement, and about the fact that God in his providence has given us at certain times great leaders who have made a great difference. If nothing else, Christians looking at that history ought to look back with a spirit of thankfulness. It really did matter that George Washington was there in the founding era to serve as our first president. Let's remember again, the constitutional office of the presidency was largely defined so that George Washington would hold it. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.